My qualifications for this are too long to start talking about. I'll just mention that I taught for 9 years in Chicago Lutheran Seminary and taught Old Testament. I taught the Old Testament Pacific Lutheran for 2 summers at Pacific Lutheran Seminary, and I taught 1 whole year at Pittsburgh Presbyterian Seminary and 2 years at Weinbrenner Seminary, and taught at Wartburg and a lot of other seminaries just for summer institutes and weekends and a lot of synods and district meetings and that sort of stuff. But that's just sort of past history, one of the many things I went through in my life as I grew up. Start a little story that I think fits in with aging more than it does with this psalm, although maybe this psalm has something to say about aging too. And that is, when we first started doing some of these things about adult children of the residents of nursing homes, I spent a little time with a social worker at Darlington House, which is the Jewish home for the aged in Toledo. And they had started even further than I had, the not only the children of the residents, but they had the grandchildren in special meetings. And when they were talking about how old is old, which was the subject that I've used before here on other occasions, one little 13-year-old Jewish boy who had just about made his bar mitzvah, or his confirmation, becoming adult, answered the question about what's the difference between being old and not. He says, well, for the first 35 years of your life, you're growing up. And the rest of your life, you're growing old. Now, that's a 13-year-old's point of view. I'm still growing up, and I think the question that people have to ask me, since my wife said I had my 16th birthday yesterday, I think, you know, you have to ask me, since I played around with all these things, what am I going to be when I grow up? I really don't know. That's in God's hands. I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up. Now, this is a Bible study. I'm the brackets around Ed and Titus. Ed Schramm's been the Bible study faculty member here, and he's been here before, and I've been here before. I had Monday, and I talked about humanity in the Old Testament. Basically, what is a person, and what is death? And obviously, you can't talk about humanity in the Old Testament without getting into sin. Humanity did that rather fast in the Old Testament. That's why Psalm 51 came. We could title this not Psalm 51, we could title it Sin in the Old Testament, because we're going to take a couple of digressions. Planned digressions, Ed, and a few that are unplanned. So we'll look at Psalm 51. I have 3 translations with me, the Jerusalem, the King James, and the RSV, and probably some of you have some others, and we'll compare some now and then. The first thing to be said about Psalm 51 is it's one of the major styles of poetry in the Old Testament book of Psalms. It's a lament. And there are more laments in the book of Psalms than any other type of psalm. Somebody has a plea to make to the Lord, lamenting either sin or sickness or enemies or whatever. And they may all be the same thing when you ultimately get down to how come you have these enemies and this sickness. Then there's some kind of reason why maybe this has happened, although that doesn't show up in Psalm 51, except in a generalized philosophical point of view. And then you have sort of a confidence that something is going to happen, that God is going to do something about the sin. And then you have the response of the forgiven, or the response of the reconciled, whatever term turns you on, to do something about it. To tell it, to declare it, to share it, to speak it, to witness to it, whatever. I mentioned the other day, Psalm 22 is another lament. But Psalm 22 is exactly like Psalm 51. It doesn't end with a lament. About verse 18, 19, 20, and 21, the whole mood shifts. And they're saved, they're delivered, and they're going to tell. It's the exact same style. If you look at those 2 psalms, which are relatively well known in Lutheran circles, Psalm 51 and Psalm 22. The next thing to say about it is a generalization about all psalms, and that is the titles and the directions about choir masters and tunes and that sort of thing are relatively late. The psalm might have been composed as much as 400 to 500 years before somebody said an authorship, or somebody said a tune, or somebody said the historical setting. Probably the authorship idea got in there first and tuned very closely, and then the historical setting, which talks about Bathsheba here, was probably added very late. It isn't in some of the early manuscripts and other things like that. When you see the word to David, we need to recognize that the word to David is Hebrew. I think the translation you have, it says a psalm of David. Psalm of David. The literal is to David. And the word to or of in Hebrew has all kinds of things. It's the word leh, if you know any Hebrew, modern or ancient. And it has all kinds of prepositional meanings. Most people feel that the word means that this is part of the hymn book of the king. To the king, or of the king's hymn book, or however you want to explain it. Not that David necessarily wrote it. Let's give you a good illustration before we start the verses. The good illustration is, back a number of years ago, a fellow by the name of Wesley wrote hymns, and a Wesley hymn book was put out. Now, we could say, this is in the hymn book of Wesley, couldn't we? But not every hymn that was in the Wesleyan hymn book was by Wesley. So this is what we're saying here. The word Dawid doesn't necessarily mean a personal name either. It has several possibilities. Because the son of Jesse, Dawid also could mean chief. It's the Hebrew word for chief. And so this could be to the chief king, his hymn book. I won't argue that one too strongly, but I think it makes more sense, because you don't get bogged down in could David have said this, or even as the last part of the heading says, when David said it. I'll use that as a sermonic, homiletic thing, but not as a liturgical or exegetical, interpretive item.
Well, Mom, just for your information, in this Bible that a lot of us are using, there are no headings at all.
Okay, that's good. It would be better if you didn't have headings, because people read the headings as if the Holy Spirit wrote them too. And they're just some kinds of editor's things that are stuck in there. Thank you, Ed, for that. Okay, I'm going to just start a few sections here. We're going to spend mainly our time on the first part and the last part, because it deals with sin and death, and then it deals with forgiveness, and that's where we are. Have mercy on me, O God, according to thy steadfast love, according to thy abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions, my sin is ever before me. Against thee, the only, have I sinned, and done that which is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified in thy sentence, and blameless in thy judgment. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Okay, that throws a whole lot of stuff and a lot of flack going around in Lutherans' minds when they read this, because you've heard some theology, you've heard some sermons on this. Let's just start with the beginning.
Pardon me a second.
Yes, sir.
My wife just called my attention to an error on my eyesight. There is, up above there, to the choir master. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Fine. They take it out of the text, which is a good thing that they've done. They don't put it down as if it's verse 1, which it almost appears to be in the King James translations. It almost looks like it's the first part of it. Here the word 51 or the letters 51 come in. Fine, Ed. Thank you. As close as you can get to the word gospel, which doesn't appear in the Old Testament, is the phrase steadfast love. Steadfast love is covenant love. And back in the 50s, when I went around and tried to sell the RSV to recalcitrant King James and St. James Version of the Bible people, I said if there was anything at all that's positive that would make me buy this over the King James translation, it would be the use of the word steadfast love. The word in Hebrew is chesed, C-H-E-S-E-D, or an H with a little sign under it, H-E-S-E-D, chesed. And that means covenanted love, God's covenant to his people. He chose them, and he guaranteed he'd love them, guaranteed he'd save them. He didn't guarantee they'd always be healthy. He didn't guarantee they'd always have Jerusalem. He didn't guarantee that. He just guaranteed, I'll love you, and you're going to be mine. Steadfast love is so much a better word than the word that we have in the King James, loving kindness. Loving kindness, what does that mean? It's almost as vague as in Psalm 103, bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. You know, benefits in its original meaning was good, but now it sounds like the Eastern Star is going to have a benefit program, or maybe it's the American Legion is going to have a bingo benefit. And we demean a great word because it has the same thing as the word benevolence in. Benefit is to make something well and to make something good and to do something good. Here, loving kindness is transferred into steadfast love. Steadfast love is the love of a covenanting God who is faithful and loyal and, in the old-fashioned sense of the word, true. We're going to get the word true later on in this verse, in this text. What does true mean? We'll do that later. Okay, so it's that that's being done. And you might note some very interesting things about the way in which some psalms, not this one particularly, but many psalms, use the word God in the beginning of the lament and change the covenant God's name when they're finally saved. Psalm 22 does that, shifts from one name of God to the other. And this one doesn't do that. This one stays, O God, most of the way. And then toward the end, it moves into Holy Spirit, and it moves into O Lord, but it's not the Lord with a capital letters. It's the Lord for Her or Adon, and we can do something about that when we get that far, if we get that far. Now, what is God's gospel love, what's his covenant love going to do? He's going to do several things with some things that are a bother of mine. Let's talk about them first. Sin in the Old and the New Testament is basically a relationship word, not a legal word. I think Vern's been pushing that for 2 weeks, that sin cannot be defined legally. Even morals can't be defined legally. You can define legal and illegal legally, which sounds like a redundancy, but that's about as far as the lawyers can go. They can't say it's moral or immoral. They can't say it's good or bad. They can't say it's sin or righteousness. That's not the job of law and legality. So, for years and years and years in my life, I never understood what Paul said when he said, that which is not in faith is sin. Remember that passage? That which is not of faith or in faith is sin. Never understood that, because I grew up on the old unrevised catechism, which said sin is every transgression against God's law. Poppycock. That isn't what sin is at all. That's what some Western European Germans said sin was, who had a legalistic, linear, rationalistic definition of sin, and they wanted to get it all down in categories. And so we get a list of sins. We even divide them into good and bad sins, moral and venial sins, and light and heavy sins, forgivable and unforgivable sins. You know, that's rationality when we do that. But if you recognize that faith is not rational, and I've used this several times as a gesture because I really like the new theory about the left hemisphere of the brain and the right hemisphere of the brain. And the left hemisphere is rational, linear, logical. And the right is relational, emotive, affective. Ornstein is the man who put this into print, although he wasn't the man who discovered the theory about 10 years ago. He put it in print in 1973. What I'm saying is that when we define faith as a bunch of dogmatic statements, we're very Western. We're very left-sided brain people, retarded on the right side like mad. I was a retarded child until I was about 54. Years of age. Really was. Because I never got, until the human potential movement and a few other things got me in touch with my feelings as well as my brain, that we usually think logic. Faith, we talk of the faiths in the world or the Christian faiths. And what we usually mean in the West is the Baptists believe this, the Presbyterians believe this, the Catholics believe this, the Methodists believe this, the Presbyterians believe this, and the Anglicans aren't sure what they believe. And so we go around with that kind of a logical thing. But Baptists are Baptists because of something up here, too, on their emotional side of life. Lutherans are dogmatists and dogmatic and sometimes overly conservative because of something over here. You break out of that bond a little bit when the charismatic movement and the Holy Spirit gets to you and hits the other side of your brain. Faith is a relationship, not a dogmatic statement. The best thing I've heard this week is something I heard years ago, but I'd forgotten it, Ed. When Ed defined faith as forsaking all, I trust him. Trust isn't a logical word. Trust isn't, he hasn't even defined faith when he said that. He's merely tried to describe it. Faith is a trusting action. Trust is a taking and belonging action. So now I'm getting to the point. That wasn't a transgression. That wasn't a digression. That wasn't a sin against your coming to a Bible study. That which is not of faith is sin. That which is not in the covenant relationship of the gospel and the grace and the Torah of a loving God must be outside of that, right? When I'm outside of the faith relationship, when I'm outside of the covenant gospel relationship, I'm in sin. Sin is also a relationship word, not a categorical word. Now, there are some categorical words in this psalm. We're going to get to them in a moment. But I need to make very clear that a sinner is not someone who commits sins. A sinner is someone who is alienated and has rebelled from God and has given up his unalienable right somehow. I don't know how he did it, but he decided if I was a child of God, I don't want to be anymore. And he tried to give it up. A sinner is not a sinner because he sins or is immoral. A person who is a sinner is one who's alienated from God's covenant love, Christ's grace, the power, the fellowship, the communion of the Holy Spirit. And because he is alienated, note the change in the cause and effect, because he is alienated, he does works, what we call unrighteousness, immorality, even illegal sometimes. But there are an awful lot of sinners who are very legal. They sin like hell with the law as their protector. And they're sinners because they're out of the gospel grace. So, that which is not a faith relationship is a rebellious relationship. So the best word in the Bible is the word that the King James always translates, transgression. Transgression, whenever you see in the King James Bible the word transgression, they're almost consistent. There are a few inconsistencies, and you know, that's a big book, that Old Testament. There are a few inconsistencies, but the word transgression usually means the alienated state. It usually means the rebel against God. The simplest way to explain it in historical terms, you all know in 2 Samuel and in Chronicles the story of Absalom's revolt. Absalom couldn't wait for the old man David to die. He thought that, you know, anybody over 40 ought to not be listened to, much less obeyed. And so he said, I'm going to be the ruler. And he got a couple of guys to try a Latin American revolution. It's the exact same kind of thing. He tried to take over in the Near East, in Israel. And the simple statement is this. Absalom rebelled against David, his father. And the word translated rebel is the exact same word that's translated transgress or transgression, just the difference between a verb and a noun. Whenever you see the word transgressed as a verb in the Psalms, translate it rebellion or rebelled. Whenever you see the word transgression or transgressions, translate it rebellion or rebellions. You Follow what we're saying? Now, let me give you the best proof that I like. Romans 1 is pretty good if you want New Testament, and some Lutherans like the New Testament better than the Old Testament, although that doesn't have to be so. If you look at the first chapter of Isaiah, first chapter of Isaiah and Psalm 51 have the same theology. Will somebody read verses 2 and 3 for me in Isaiah chapter 1? Isaiah chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. Anybody?
Hear, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know. My people doth not consider.
Okay, isn't that clear? You know, an ox and an ass have more loyalty to a master than a human being does to God. There, we talk about stubborn mules, but we're worse than stubborn mules from God's point of view. Sons we've nourished, reared, cared for, and they've rebelled. And that word rebel is the same word, root word, that we have here in Psalm 51, translated transgression. It's the exact same word. I think that's probably as clear as I could do it. We could spend a lot of time on that without any trouble. Now, I'm going to deal with a couple of other words which do have to do with, after you're a rebel, then certain things happen, right? After I'm a rebel, I begin to break statutes. I begin to give Vern and other lawyers various cases that they have to send to the Supreme Court to figure out whether I should be punished or not. I tend to do other things that maybe my wife and my children don't like, and maybe I even harm them a little bit at times. But that doesn't make me a sinner, because I was already alienated and a rebel. I did these other things. So the next three or four words that you see down there are words that are related to the various kinds of law, which I talked about on, gee, that was last week already. We talked about law as statute and law as case study, and we talked about law as statements written from an authority on high, an apodictic law. Thou shalt not is one kind of law. If a man is caught in the field with a woman, not his wife, that's another kind of law, right? And if you get some other statements that might say law, that when you see such and such happening and you do not do this, that's still another third kind of law. Now, they have words that relate to that on the opposite side, various kinds of sin. Let's just look at them for a moment. I think it might be fun. The word iniquity is in the RSV. It's guilt in the Jerusalem Bible, and I think it's still iniquity in the King James. The word iniquity is the word for I do twisted things. Awen is the way it's spelled, A-W-E-N, or it could be spelled in another pronunciation and another version of the word, own, with a little book before it, which I never pronounce because those people wonder what I'm doing. I think I'm talking African or something. But if you take a guttural and then O-N or A-W-E-N, it means twisted. You're twisted. Your life isn't straight in connection, and so you twist the laws. You know, I guess the legal word might be loopholes. The sinner can find more loopholes than the person who's loyal. He can find more ways of not only using the law, but evading the law. That's a term that's popular right now. So we've got the word own come here, which is the word for iniquity. And then you've got the next most frequently occurring word, which is translated by the word sin in verse 2. And I think that's in all three versions. Yeah, Jerusalem Bible, King James, and RSV has the word sin. And this word could be spelled something like this, C-H-A-T-A, chata, chata, C-H-A-T-A would be the way. Chata is the closest to the Greek word that is normally used for sin, which means coming short. I didn't quite make it to the goal of perfection. If I was supposed to love my neighbor as myself, I didn't love either of us enough. I came short of the goal. Most of the Greek talk about in the New Testament talks about that kind of word, coming short of the glory of God. So when you see the word chata or sin, and again, the King James is relatively consistent that the word sin is translated chata, not always. Now verse 3, you see they occur again. I just want to get one more word in here before we finish with the words on sin. I know my transgression, my sin is ever before me. Then I have done that which is evil. Now the word, against thee only have I sinned, that's the word pesha again, that's the word rebel. Against thee only have I rebelled. It really ought to be translated that way if we wanted to be consistent. You know, blot out all my rebellions, and against thee only have I rebelled. You can't tell that from the English, can you? Because they've used two different words. But it is the same word. You ought to trust me for that. But I can go get the Hebrew Bible and point it out if you insist. Now, right below that, there's another word. Done that which is evil in your sight. That's fairly close to the word that we think of as evil or violence. Violent crime is on the increase in America. Whether it's because of TV or not, somebody else's business. I don't know the answer to that one. But violent crime is on the increase. And the word ra, R-A, is the way it's spelled in Hebrew. Ra is violent crime. It's the evil that people do to others. Beat them over the head. Kill them. Do all kinds of things, including rape. All of these violent crimes are covered under the word evil here. And again, the King James is relatively consistent. So that whenever you see the word evil, you can guess it means violent crime. It means ra, on that sense. Now, before we get out of sin, let's stay with it for a while. Are there some questions you have about these several delineations? Sin is a rebellious relationship. Sins are the result of that broken relationship. Do you follow what I'm saying? Then we have several categories under that, just as we have several categories and types of law, whether it's in the state of Washington or the book of Leviticus. We have several types. Some questions before we move on to how we get rid of some of this and how long we've had it. Oh boy, that's a mean question. Any questions?
Does the word law ever comprehend law and gospel in the Old Testament?
Yes, Ed, the again, Vern and I had a seminar last week on law and gospel, and we never answered the full question as to how Vern's going to live like that as being a lawyer and a Christian at the same time. It's tough enough for a preacher to be a preacher and a Christian at the same time. But I know it's much worse to be a lawyer and a Christian at the same time. Right, Bert? Or at least you're struggling with it. So am I. We struggle with it. There are some problems with that. The closest we could come, and I think this, is the word Torah. Torah is God's guidance, God's instruction, God's covenantal love, which gives a chance for you to know where to go. That's the closest word of law that will include gospel. But the word we started with in this text, chesed, is the real gospel word in the Old Testament. Chesed, which means God's covenantal love, which chose Israel when they didn't deserve it. You know, in Amos it says, I could have picked Philistines if I wanted to. Could have had Ethiopians. They'd have been maybe even better than you Jews. And in Deuteronomy, to make it sure, whether Moses said it or not, I won't argue the point, but it said, God has not chosen you because you were the greatest among all the peoples of the world. God chose you because you were the least. That sort of takes it away from self-righteousness pretty quick, that I deserve to be God's chosen people. And so, steadfast love, chesed, if you want to stay King James, loving kindness is the gospel. So If I wanted to New Testamentize this psalm, Ed, I would say, "Forgive me, O Jesus Christ, because of the gospel you are."
You are.
Because you see, if I don't say gospel is a relationship with someone, then I got to get all into these arguments about what is the true gospel and what is the true definition of gospel. But gospel is what Jesus was in relationship to me and is. Some more questions?
I've got a question.
Sure.
Do you think that the distinction you're drawing between sin in the relational sense and sin in the legal sense is similar to the distinction that's drawn in Romans, the first 8 chapters, between sin as far as the state of being and sin as acts?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah, I think Paul was still pretty Jewish in the first couple of chapters. In fact, Romans 1 and Isaiah 1, I would say, are practically saying the same thing. Yeah, that's a very good observation you made. Any other observations about sin? We're going to deal with sin some more. Maybe. Let's say, look at time. Okay, let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of sin. There are all kinds of words now in the same set, plus a few others. Wash me, cleanse me, blot out, and so on. You see all those words? There are some others that are really tough. I think we have later on, we got the word purge, don't we? Is that in there somewhere? Verse 7. Yeah, okay, purge, right. And then you got wash again on those. All of these words are image words. I tried to build a fire. I didn't succeed very well in keeping it going. But getting up and getting the sawdust, getting in where there was already charcoal, I said, keep the fire burning while I go wash my hands. That's a simple image. I wash the charcoal and the dirt off my hands. So we're going to wash. And you note what he washes? He washes the twistedness off of me, the kind of thing. He doesn't wash the rebellion off of me. Rebellion doesn't get washed off. He washes that kind of thing off that's twisted. And if you want to use the word dirty there, you could do that. Cleanse me, that's a stronger word. That's before Old Dutch was invented. And you just took some small sand and you cleaned your pans as they do on hikes up here by rubbing the sand. It's really the word for scour. Now sometimes I have to use Murphy's oil soap to clean my hands when I've worked pretty hard. So in a way I'm almost scouring. Sometimes I take soap that's called sand soap. Some of you have used that if you've worked a lot with grease. Or maybe you just use plain sand. That's the image that's used there. And what are you washing or cleansing there? You're cleansing the chata. You're cleansing the sin that is shortcoming. You're getting rid of that. And then the evil, it doesn't talk about that. It talks about purge. See, all these first two words, wash and scour, are external. But I grew up on castor oil. it would have helped Luther if it had been invented in those days. We'd have had a whole different theology of the law if Luther had had castor oil. Or even castoria. And that's what it means. Purge me. Clean me out. Not with flu, but with your gentle love. And that's a good image. We may not like to use it, but it's a beautiful image. If sin can permeate all of me, if evil is the twisted thing in me that makes for violence, I got to be purged. I got to have it taken away from me. And it's taken away by the mercy of God, and so on. Now, if sin is a relationship, I need to experience the fact that I'm a sinner. Luther did, Paul did, most people in the Bible experience themselves as sinners. And I go to my left and right brain. When we have confession in the Western Church, frequently, especially in the Roman Catholic and the Episcopal Church, but also traditionally in the Lutheran Church, it's this. We enumerate where we think of what was a sin that we once did, rather than feeling, as Luther did, I'm unworthy. We're like the publican in the temple, God be merciful to me, a sinner.
The sinner, the Greek says.
The sinner is the way it says. The sinner personified, and Paul uses the same word, of whom I am chief. And we got that old hymn Ed likes to sing, chief of sinners though I be. That's the emphasis.
Incidentally, excuse me.
Sure.
Someone called my attention, this is in the new hymnal.
Very good.
Well, from henceforth, I shut my mouth on that one.
Okay. So it's there, all right? But what you're saying, you see, when you say, I am chief sinner, that's not a statement of rationality. That's a statement that you have an emotional experience. Now, we Lutherans, until the charismatic movement came along, were awfully afraid of Pentecostal confession. We were awfully afraid of people making an emotional, we maybe even thought they were sick if they emotionally said, woe is me, I'm undone, kind of thing. But that's really what it is. You know, if sin is a relationship, we talked about, I don't know whether it was yesterday or 2 days ago, about divorce and dissolution of marriages. And Vern said that at least in 82%, at least one of the persons involved is so traumatized that they can't even think straight, can't even make reconciliation discussions straight and honest. That's a horrible figure. But it shows that when you break a relationship, you don't break it logically. And your repercussions aren't logical. They're emotional. So when I sin, when I rebel, the consequences of that are not something that I enumerate. Now I've done six of these, Father, give me so much penance for that. And I've done 30 of these, and give me that. I had a few of these little venial sins. You can excuse those, can't you, Father? We Lutherans do that, except for one thing. We've got one sin that proves we're not Lutheran, but that we're Puritan and Presbyterian. We act as if adultery is the unforgivable sin. Preachers can do all kinds of things except run away with the organist. If he runs away with the organist, he can't come back with her, at least to that church. And in most synods and districts, he maybe even gets off the clerical roll. If he happens to murder his wife in a fit of anger, we forgive him. And he goes, finds another wife in another church. Or maybe the other church gathers around him and supports him, knowing that there was such trauma in his life that too bad he didn't get to a psychiatrist soon enough. If he embezzles the church treasury, we forgive him, because the LCA has a blanket bond for all employees of LCA churches. And, you know, the church gets its money back and the preacher doesn't get persecuted too much. That's all logical. You see what we've done? But when it's a rupture, whether it's divorce, and that's why the prophets were always talking about a bunch of harlots going around. They weren't just saying that these people were guilty of adultery, which is what a lot of people think. They were. They were guilty of some Canaanite practices in the fertility cult. But when he calls them adulteresses, he says, here, I thought I was married to you. And you went a whoring after so-and-so. Maybe God was traumatized, and that's what the cross is all about. Maybe he's one of the 82%. That God was so traumatized, he died on the cross. Because we ran away and rebelled him and said, God, I want a divorce. That's an analogy I never thought of, thanks. But I think it makes some sense. To me, it does. Nobody else has to buy my sense. My theology is always the theology according to Umhau anyhow. So, look like a question over here.
Verse 9.
Yeah.
Blot out all my iniquities. What's the difference between iniquity and sin?
All right. Very simply, the word iniquity is in verse 2, and that's what I had said is basically the kind of thing that says we've got a twisted life, a twisted mind, a twisted emotional relationship. So iniquity is the word on or awain in Hebrew. And these words, for since you have blot out, we've got another image. There's one more that isn't in here that's in Psalm 103. Blot out means really take it away, like you use blotting paper. A lot of the new generation doesn't even know what blotting paper is, although I understand regular ink is coming back. So that you can make blots on your paper and make a mess of your letters that you write people, and then use a blotter and blot it up. There's another one that's in Psalm 103. Remove my transgressions. Remove it from me. Which means take it away, as far as the east is from the west. And that's, again, an image, because if you move it that far away, unless you believe Kipling, you'll eventually come back and be at the same place. But, you know, east is east and west is west. I think Kipling said one time, or somebody said that. That's another word for remove. Now, any other questions before I go on to verse 4? I'm going to lead into 3 and 4 here, and then I'm going to lead into 5, and then we'll be finished with sin. For the moment, intellectually. Okay, I said it's a relationship, and I got started on that primarily because of verse 3. I know my sin. And the Hebrew word for know is not intellectual. The Hebrew word for sin is relational, emotional, experiential. Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore a child named Cain. He knew her again, and there was Abel. Joseph, who knew not Mary, well, sure he did. They were good acquaintances. They maybe even had some fiddler on the roof matchmaker, helped marry them. Knew the ancestors and the relatives in the little town of Nazareth. You know, it's like you grew up in a small town in Ohio or Minnesota or Washington. You know, when I came here, somebody said, oh, you're from Toledo. Do you know so-and-so? And I said, no. And they just looked aghast that I didn't know that person in Toledo. Then I came to find out they were talking about Toledo, Washington. But Toledo, Washington is quite small compared to a 350,000 town like Toledo, Ohio. Then when we got that cleared up, they excused me and forgave me my sin of not knowing their friend. But this is what we're saying. Knowledge in the Old Testament is experience. Do we still use the word carnal knowledge in legal terms?
Yes.
That's still used. Carnal knowledge. That doesn't mean you've...
Also criminal conversation.
That's right. That's the conversation has the same thing, meaning it's experience and doing. It's not thinking about it. So carnal knowledge doesn't mean that you've read Alex Comfort's 2 books, Joy of Sex and More Joy of Sex. Sure, that's carnal knowledge. It's knowledge about sex organs and sex relations and sex positions and sex attitudes. And it's a great book. I recommend it if you haven't read it. It's a very good book, The Joy of Sex. But he's not talking intellectually about that. And all the sex education courses I gave in Chicago in the high schools before the right-wingers started saying you shouldn't do that because it's communist and you're teaching birth control and all that kind of stuff, you know, I wasn't giving carnal knowledge. I wasn't even giving pornographic knowledge out. I was giving intellectual knowledge out. Because until those high school kids had experienced puberty, or until they had known what petting or an orgasm was, they hadn't any knowledge of sex. They had knowledge about sex, but they didn't have knowledge about sex. So, this guy, whoever he is, I know my rebellion. I know the dissolution that's happening to me because the covenant love has been repudiated by me. And against, well, no, let's go to the rest of that. My sin is ever before me. God, it's staring me in the face every time I look at the mirror. My favorite illustration for this, if I were sermonizing, and I halfway am now, is Lady Macbeth. Out, damn it, spot. She couldn't get that spot of blood off her hand. my rebellion haunts me, this man says. And then let's just use the heading, even though it's a homiletic heading. A psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after he'd gone into Bathsheba. And you remember the steps of getting the seer, taking a bath, then getting her husband killed, and then inviting her over to the house, and then finally having a child with her. There were some linear steps that I think this was a little bit here first, but boy, he logically figured it out from there on in. He was a good Western German figuring out how to seduce the housemaid. And he made a good job. Otherwise, he couldn't have gotten so, you know, he'd have gone over and taken her if it had been all emotion. And he wouldn't have worried about Uriah coming in with a hatchet or not. But he thought it out, and he got Uriah put up into the front line so he could get killed. So he was working it. But now you see, we could say, and human psychology sometimes says, how could I do this great sin and sin against Uriah, my company commander? I betrayed Jewish brotherhood, or I betrayed Christian fellowship if I run away with the organist. How can I do that to my good friend? I might even be Sir Galahad to myself and say, how could I do this to my own self-image? Sin against me and my integrity and my self-worth, then damage that. I might even think of Bathsheba and say, gee, the poor little sheep, which is the Nathan parable, how could I do that to her when she was so trusting of me? But that isn't what he confesses, does he? He says very simply, against thee, against God, have I sinned. And that's the word pesha again. Against thee, the only, have I rebelled and done this twisted, dirty, evil thing in thy sight. And I'm not tying it only to Bathsheba's and David's adultery. I'm using that as the homiletic. Done this which was twisted and evil in your sight. Remember the Potiphar story and Joseph? Same thing could have been done in Potiphar, couldn't it? Joseph could have said, I really shouldn't betray your husband. He's been a friend of mine. He gave me the position I got. You know, if you sleep with your employer's wife, you've not only committed adultery, you've betrayed a trust. But you've also committed a rebellion. And so he says that. He could have said, you're a nice woman. I don't want to cause you any trouble. Have your husband kick you out and send you back to Luxor or somewhere. He could have said that, but he didn't. He said, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Very consistent, you see. Where does it come from? It comes from the other place. It comes from that total rebellion, alienation. Now, verse 5. Here's where the gospel according to Umhal differs from the gospel according to St. Paul. St. Paul used the traditional Jewish concept of, quote, original sin, end of quote. He talked like Presbyterians about, quote, inherited sin, unquote. He talked about the kind of thing that since the first Adam did it, we all do it. And I'll agree with him at that point. But I don't agree with his causality. This is not a statement of original sin in Psalm 51, verse 5. It's a statement, and that's why I have it up here. It's a statement of universal sin. There has always been sin, and there has always been sin in all of me in the rebellion, and there has always been sin through all of time. He's not talking about causality. Let's use the Bathsheba thing again. Nathan came in and said, thou art the man. Now David could have said, gee, I was a sinner last night. And in a way, that might have been true. He was a sinner last night. He broke a law or several laws, including murder and adultery and a few other things. But then his emotions and his proper theology took over. He said, no, He said, I was a sinner before I looked and took her and killed her husband. Jesus would say the lust was it. He said, nah, long before I ever knew Bathsheba ever lived, I was a sinner. I was a rebel. And then he could think of some of the things when he did some things about his other wives, and he did some things about Saul, and he did a few other things around. And then he might even go back to foreign, I don't know whether they had bar mitzvahs in David's time or not, but he might have said, you know, when I became a man, that's when I started to sin. When I began to have the evidence of puberty bouncing around in my body, and then I was a sinner. And he said, nope. Long before I was bar mitzvahed, I was a sinner, I was a rebel against God. When I was born, maybe that's when it happened. But no, he says that. He says, nope, it goes back to the very moment when I was conceived. I've been a sinner, a rebel all my life. Now the problem is that in sin did my mother conceive me, acts as if it was her problem. You know, and so we get people saying sexual relations is the greatest sin, or that kind of thing. And that's how it's conveyed. And little babies that were baptized last night, they got to get rid of original sin because daddy and mama had them not by immaculate conception. And therefore they got to be forgiven, and the poor little baby got conceived in sin. That's some Lutheran and some non-Lutheran churches teach that, unfortunately. But that's not what this says. Jeremiah says it better. He doesn't use that in sin did my mother conceive me. He says it, I have been a rebel from my mother's womb. That says it a little bit better. Doesn't put the blame on Mame. It doesn't put the blame on Eve. It doesn't put the blame on the papa and the mama who conceived this child. It puts the blame on the universal human condition. That I, ever since I have been I, have been a rebel. Because until I move from alienation to a relationship of faith, I'm alienated. I'm a rebel. So he's simply saying a very, very honest statement. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, my birth, and in sin since my mother's womb I've been that way. This isn't a story of original sin. This is a story of universal, total sin. That the condition of man without God is alienation and rebellion. And that's why the next sentence makes sense. If it's about sexual sin or about inherited sin, the next sentence doesn't make any sense. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward being. Thou desirest truth. Now here again, you see, that's a lousy word. Because for truth to us, we think of truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Or this is the truth of the gospel. Or this is the true meaning of the cross. See how we use those words all up here. But the Hebrew word for truth and the proper word for truth, and I think you'll see it in several translations, the real meaning is loyalty. Loyalty. Ed could sing it, but I refuse to sing in Bible studies. I don't have that kind of voice. But you remember that song, I went down south, my true love for to see. What does true love mean? It means even though I've been up north fighting the Yankees, she's true to me. She's my true love. She's my loyal love. She won't be alienated from me when I get back from the war. She's there. And that's what the word truth means. Most
I'll sing a little bit of one for you that doesn't, may be better than that.
Go ahead, sing.
True-hearted, whole-hearted, faithful and loyal, King right. of our lives, by thy grace we will.
Exactly. True-hearted, and then they have the word loyal as another list. True-hearted, whole-hearted, loyal. The word is there. So thanks, Ed. That really puts it right in.
That was very poor singing, but...
Well, it's all right. Well, that's why we didn't clap. If it had been better, we'd have clapped. Thanks, Ed, very much, because that is a good illustration. True heart, it doesn't mean that your heart knows all the right and true and correct statements about philosophy or about theology or about the gospel or about the law or about Paul or about David. It just says you're going to stick in there somehow. But you're not going to be able to do it all by yourself. You see, this is a desire. You desire loyalty in the inward being, in the gut, not up here. Doesn't even say in the heart at this particular point, except in the next word. Therefore, teach me wisdom. What's wisdom? Wisdom is the way in which a man walks or a woman walks. The wisdom to walk with God. So when you talk about wisdom literature, the book of Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, you're not talking just about this. You're talking about how a person forms his life and cares for his life. And you desire that kind of walking with God. Then fill me instead of out damned spot. I know my sin. God help me. I'm a misery. Fill me with joy and gladness. Note, it's a prayer. It's not saying I'm going to go out and get happy. Any more than it's saying I'm going to start being loyal and be the best Boy Scout. A scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, brave, clean, reverent, and all the rest of them. That's not it. It's not in my power to do it. Even in the Old Testament, it isn't. We sometimes put down the Old Testament and are Marcionites, people who said the Old Testament shouldn't be in the Christian faith. That's not true. The Old Testament is saying, God is the one who chose me. God is the one who purges me. God is the one who fills me after I've been purged. There's an empty spot in there after you've had all that castor oil. And you got to be filled again. Otherwise, you know, you got to go take some kaopectate. And that isn't what God's going to fill you up with. He's going to fill you up with something else that's more vital than that. Fill me with joy and gladness. Hide thy face from my sins and blot out my iniquities. Blot out and hide, we've already talked about. Hide is the little game that we play. If God doesn't look at it, you know, when my grandchildren or my children were around 1.5 or 2, they'd put their hands in front of their eyes and say, Daddy, you can't see me. And that's, in a way, the image here. We're saying, God, if you want to be gracious and gentle to me, you won't look at these things. You won't look at my heart. You won't do that. You'll just call me back and fondle me and love me to death. And I'll enjoy it. Now, the most familiar passage for many Lutherans is beginning now, verses 10 and 11, because we sing it often in our communion service. Create to me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Who does it? It's a whole new creation. The word create is always the subject of God. Man never creates in the Old Testament. Man can make some things, man can build some things, man can do some things, but the word create is reserved in the entire Old Testament. There's no exception to the act of God. It's a theological statement that the Hebrews were very consistent on. They're sometimes inconsistent in the Old Testament, just like Paul and James don't always agree, and Matthew and John don't always agree. But on this, Moses to Malachi, David to Solomon, and Job all agree that creation is the act of God. So create a clean heart and a new, that's a creation. Not that old one that's been rebelling all along or forever. And then comes the word right spirit within me. The Jerusalem Bible translates it constant spirit, which gets awful close to loyalty again. And if you look at the RSV, some of you might see a little note down there after right. It says why. And down at the why, you say, put a steadfast spirit in me. So I'll stay loyal to you despite all the enemies, despite all the sickness, despite all the calamities, I won't rebel again. And that's what's going on. Now, I think I'd better quit because I'm almost over time. Just to finish the statement here, after I'm restored, after I'm whole, after I'm a totally new person, then I will respond and teach transgressors. I will teach other rebels what you can do for rebels like us. That's all he's saying. And I'll show praise and all the rest. I think that's clear. I think to be renewed, to take not the Holy Spirit from me, I'll close with that, is really picking up Genesis 2:7 and Ecclesiastes 12:7. It's saying, if you take it away from me, I'm dead, God. And I want to live, and I want to celebrate, and I want to have joy. So don't take your life-giving spirit from me, because when that's gone, I'm gone. And in the Old Testament, there wasn't much hope of an eternal life. The hope was in their children, or in the nation's covenant continuing, or in a long life. So don't let me die, that's all he's saying. If you want to make that in a paraphrase, don't let me die now, God. I'm just beginning to enjoy it. Time is up. I preached a long sermon, didn't give you much chance to answer questions, but you see it's got a lot of stuff in it. This psalm says a lot. If you know what this psalm says, you practically know the whole Old Testament. It says almost everything that you need to know about the Old Testament. And Old Testament theology, if you want to. It talks about the totality of man, the total dependence of man on God, the total rebellion of man, and the total bringing him back again, and the total annihilation of him when he's dead and gone. Thanks very much. Thank you for coming. Thank you.